Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
This summer, we've marked 100 years since the beginning of World War I. It was a war where, in many respects, Canada forged its international identity. We sit down for a two-part interview with Tim Cook, a historian, an author, and the director of research at the Canadian War Museum.
Cook discusses how Canadians were feeling as the Great War began, how our soldiers' sacrifices shaped our nation, and how the war changed the political relationship between the people and the government.
3 years ago, Elizabeth May became the first MP to be elected under the Green Party banner. There are now two Greens in the House of Commons, but the party faces pressure as both the Liberals and NDP show strength ahead of the next election. To talk about the challenges and strategies for the Greens, we're joined by leader Elizabeth May.
And the U.S. Ambassador to Canada, Bruce Hayman, sits down to talk about the relationship between our two countries, the border, and the Keystone XL pipeline.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. 100 years ago this summer, the First World War began. In many respects, Canadian identity was forged in its trenches. Nobody knows more about Canada's 1914 to 1918 experience than Tim Cook, author of several award-winning books about the First World War.
And this fall, the first volume of his ambitious two-volume history of World War II, entitled The Necessary War, is slated to be published. Tim Cook is director of research at the Canadian War Museum, and he spoke with John Geddes about World War I on the centenary of its outbreak.
All right, Tim, thank you for talking to us about this. You've written about World War I from every angle, from the standpoint of Canadians at home, troops in the trenches, their generals, the politicians who were trying to make policy and strategy during the whole thing. But could I start with a sort of just framing the summer of 1914 a little bit? Starting point, a lot of us who have just a sketchy understanding of the First World War and its outbreak, we know that the ignition or the spark was supposedly the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand. Did that resonate at all in Canada? Did Canadian politicians have any idea about the assassination? Did they have any inkling that it might lead to bigger and worse things?
I there was coverage of it. So if you look at the newspapers from the day, they were reporting on this assassination. But I think 99 out of 100, or perhaps a far greater number of Canadians would not have even known where Austria was on a map,
right,
let alone who the Archduke was and his role in the monarchy there. So just as Canadians were well aware of international affairs, and Canadians at the time were a newspaper-reading nation. Of course,
right,
there's no radio, there's no television. They read newspapers. This is how they got their news. And there was quite a lot of coverage of the lead-up to war. So the assassination of the Archduke, and then Austria-Hungary's heavy response to that against Serbia, which was seen as supporting the terrorists who had ultimately killed the Archduke, and then the gradual spiral towards war that brought in Germany and Russia and France and ultimately Belgium and Britain, their colonies, dominions, and the world. And what's interesting is I think that for many years historians have written about the summer of 1914, in Canada at least, as the last good summer, this idyllic summer. No one saw storm clouds on the horizon. To some degree, that's true. But if you look at the newspapers, if you were reading papers, just like today, you had a sense of what was happening overseas. And as this begins to spiral out of control, you see articles that are warning against using words like the coming Armageddon.
Wow.
Because they understood at the time that Russia, Germany, Austria, these nations had armies of hundreds of thousands of professional soldiers. And then, of course, they could draw upon these large civilian bases, that these were industrialized nations, that they had thousands of machine guns and artillery pieces at their disposal. They had large navies. And that if there was going to be a war, it would be long and costly.
Hmm.
Now, I think most people think that there's an accepted vision that when war came, that it was going to be short and fast. Now, there were people who were talking about that.
Right.
But I think you have to balance that against the fact that the reporters and the newspapers were saying quite clearly, it may be short and fast. It may also be very long and costly. And all of that, I think, is part of this lead-up to the 4th of August, 1914, when Canada finds itself at war.
And you say finds itself at war because we didn't really declare war. We weren't really even consulted about getting into the war. Is that correct?
That's right, and I think that's worth emphasizing. We were a British dominion within the British Empire, and when Britain went to war, Canada went to war. What we did decide, though, as Canadians, was the extent of our commitment. And it could have been like the South African War 15 years earlier. It could have been ultimately 7,000 or 8,000 patriotic, largely English-speaking Canadians drawn from large cities who went off to fight the Boers on the veldt. But things had changed 15 years later. This was now a major European war, already framed from the start as a war for liberal ideas, which we might call a war for democratic values.
Interesting.
And it was a war against German militarism. Germany had invaded neutral Belgium, which had brought Britain into the war, which ultimately brought us into the war. And that was a naked act of aggression.
Tim, could I interrupt you for a sec? I'm interested in your saying it was a war for liberal values, sort of democratic values. Is that fair?
That's right.
Because sometimes people think back and they look at the posters and stuff, think, well, it was a war for the British flag and the crown or something. But it was framed in more philosophic terms than that?
I think it
more...
was. Yeah, if you look at the language of the time, if you look what politicians are saying, if you look at what the press is saying, well, there's a hearty dose here of we will stand by Britain through
right.
thick and thin,
the mother country.
But there's also a framing of that this is a war of liberal rights, and the liberation of Belgium, which is a small country that has been invaded by its militaristic neighbor,
right.
And that this is ultimately a much of the discourse and language you see in 1914 and 15. It changes during the course of the war. Certainly as more and more Canadians begin to die overseas, we also see an impetus here on the fact that we must now support those soldiers who have fallen.
Right,
in effect, John McCrae's famous poem in Flanders Fields, "To you from failing hands we throw the torch, be yours to hold it high." That's a recruiting poem.
Right.
And it's interesting how that has taken on a life of its own as well.
Tim, I want to get on to some of the stuff you've just alluded to, but before we leave 1914, Canadians, lots of Canadians who know a bit of history, think of the war as being a period when Canada kind of came into its own in terms of political independence and being seen on the world stage as being sovereign or close to fully sovereign. But I wonder, could you say, just thinking again about the early months of the war, how early in 1914 did political leaders in Canada, I guess Prime Minister Borden among them, start to think of the war in those terms? I think you've written, correct me if my memory's wrong here, about a speech you gave in Montreal in late 1914 as having almost foreshadowed his notion that there's an issue of Canadian independence or Canadian clout at stake.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Would you?
I think so. I think there's two important questions you've asked there. The first is we went to war on the 4th of August 1914 as a British dominion without control over our foreign policy. We ended the war on November 11th, 1918 as a British dominion without control over our foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
That's important to keep in mind. There is no independence here during the course of the war. What historians argue, and I'm one of them, is that during the course of the war, things begin to change, and that Sir Robert Borden, our Prime Minister of the day, who was initially quite willing to simply send soldiers overseas that would fight with the British, he didn't care much about Canadian identity, Canadian independence, Canadian control, that changes during the war. And for Borden, it's the fact that we make this terrible blood sacrifice, that we are sending our young boys overseas, that they are fighting in key battles like at Second Ypres and the Somme and Vimy, Passchendaele, the 100 Days Campaign, that we are contributing incredible amounts of foodstuffs, wheat and grain. We were an agricultural nation. We're feeding the world. A munitions industry that springs up. And by 1917, one-fourth of all British shells fired on the Western Front are made in Canada.
Is that right?
These are significant contributions by Canada. And early in 1917, Borden goes overseas. When things are very dark in the war, this is right after the Battle of the Somme, 1 million casualties to the French and the Germans and the British, 24,000 Canadian casualties. He goes overseas and he says, we will keep sending men. We believe in this war. This is important. Having said that, I want something out of it.
Mm.
And that's Borden's important drafting of Resolution Number 9, which I think most Canadians have never heard of. But really, it was a critical constitutional document, I guess, which said that Britain, at the end of the war, so once we've won this thing, Britain will renegotiate with its dominions and give them control over foreign policy. Now, it will take another 13 years until the Statute of Westminster in 1931 to fully come to that realization. Hmm. But most historians say that comes out of the war, a greater sense of who we are as a people, a pride in having stood shoulder to shoulder with Britain, and a blood sacrifice that had to mean something.
The sort of riveting title of your book on the second half of the First War is Shock Troops.
Right.
That's such an interesting term. What does it mean? Like, if people are thinking about Canadian troops in the war, should we think of them as shock troops? And if that's the right way to think of them, what was that?
Well, in At the Sharpen and Shock Troops, I divided up the war into two periods. The first 2 years at the Sharpen, 1915 and 16, those are the battles that the Canadians fought, the 1st Division at 2nd Ypres, the gas attack in April of 1915, a series of battles that came after that. It's hard to find a lot of victories there, where the Canadians were fighting on the defensive at 2nd Ypres. They had a failed attack at Festubert in May of 1915, where they lose 2,500 men in fruitless bayonet charges against German lines. The Battle of Saint-Éloi in April of 1916 is a clear-cut failure. Montsorel is a draw at best that costs another 10,000 Canadians killed and wounded. The Somme, another 24,000. But then in April of 1917, we have Vimy Ridge, and that is a significant tactical victory for the Canadians. We are now four divisions strong in a Canadian corps, 100,000 in strength. And I think that's a figure for Canadians to think about. I mean, we certainly don't and could never field 100,000 strong fighting formation today. Mm. This was an army of civilian soldiers as well. They were volunteers. They were farmers and clerks and bankers and every other profession. And over time, there is a learning process here from those two difficult years at the beginning, learning how to fight more effectively, more effective weapons, how to wield them together with doctrines and tactics forged in the fire of war. We are learning from the British. We're learning from the French. We are putting this together. After Vimy, there is a string of victories where we never lose another battle.
Hmm.
The battle at Hill 70 in August of 1917, at Passchendaele 2 months later, in defense of Vimy in March and April of 1918, and finally the 100 Days Campaign.
Which was a devastating campaign,
where the Canadians are thrown into one difficult battle after another. And I think that's where the Canadians really acquire that reputation as shock troops. And what does it mean? It is you throw your best troops into the most difficult part of the line to shock the enemy and to break his formations.
Wow.
Now, the challenge there, in which I write about it in Shock Troops, but also in The Madman, the Butcher, my book on Currie and Sam Hughes, was that that 100 Days campaign, we should take pride in that. That was a series of successful victories, operational victories.
Yeah.
At the same time, we lost 46,000 killed and wounded during that time.
Out
period.
Of about, what?
About 100,000.
About 100,000. That's an astonishing casualty rate.
If you were a frontline infantryman, you probably had about an 85% chance of being killed or wounded during time period. Now, these are guys who are looking around, seeing all their best friends who have survived the war being wiped out in battle after battle. And that's a period where I looked at that of Sir Arthur Currie, our most famous and final corps commander, Canadian-born, regarded as a very fine general, and I think so as well. But he continued to use the Canadians as shock troops, and the British were asking him to throw into the line, and he couldn't very well say no. We reported through the British generals. But those 46,000 casualties remain a heavy specter, I think, over the justifiable pride that some may have. And it leads to questions like, how much is too much? Shouldn't the Canadians have been cycled out and other troops put instead? Well, if you had done that and they were less effective, there would have been casualties, but to other troops, British or Scottish or Irish. That isn't to say that the British didn't have some very good shock troops of their own. They did. They had about 60 divisions, and probably 10 of them were elite, of which Canadians and Australians form another 9 or 10 divisions on top of that. But we are part of that spearhead.
Hmm.
And that is, I think, what is meant generally by that term, shock troops.
Wow.
But it comes, shock troops, almost by definition, are the ones who also take the heaviest casualties.
That was historian Tim Cook of the Canadian War Museum in conversation with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief, John Geddes.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Tim Cook, where he explains how the First World War brought major political change that has impacted our country to this very day. And we speak later with Green Party leader Elizabeth May and the U.S. Ambassador to Canada, Bruce Hayman. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come, Green Party leader Elizabeth May joins us to discuss the state of her party leading up to the 2015 election. And U.S. Ambassador Bruce Hayman sits down to talk about Canada-U.S. relations.
But first, we continue the conversation with Tim Cook, Director of Research at the Canadian War Museum. It has been 100 years since the outbreak of the First World War, and Cook sits down with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes to explain how the Great War brought in major political changes that we still see today.
Tim, you've written extensively on the First World War, but I know that you're just now about to embark. Well, you've already written the first volume of your planned two-volume Second World War book, The Necessary War,
that's
correct?
Right.
It's coming out in the fall.
Yeah.
It seems to me that if you go to the shortest of shorthands on the wars, when Canadians think of the First World War, maybe people from other countries too, they think of the trenches and the mud. Mm-hmm. And when they think of the Second World War, they think about defeating Hitler. You know,
sure.
That one is framed in terms of the physical, grueling physical circumstances of the war, and the other is framed in terms of the mission.
Yeah.
Is that, what do you make of that, the way that we've mythologized the wars? Is it accurate? What does it do?
That's a very good question. I think you're right that the war of the imagination in the Great War is of the trenches on the Western Front.
Right.
Now, of course, this was a worldwide war. It's fought in the Middle East. It's fought in Africa, fought in Asia, fought on the Eastern Front. The war between Italy and Austria is a mountain war for the most part. It's an incredibly war. It's a war fought on most of the oceans, in the air. But it is those trenches that have a hold on our imagination. There's something horrible and awful about that.
But transfixing, too.
That's right. 700 kilometers of trenches running from Switzerland to the North Sea. This sort of 20-kilometer swath of utter destruction where soldiers live cheek to jowl with the dead, unburied corpses, the rats, the lice, the filth, and the constant wastage, the death and destruction. Now that, of course, is where Canada's Corps fought in the war. And so it is the right place to think of for Canada's war effort in the First World War. The Second World War, I think you're right, it is about Hitler's war. It's about beating Hitler. Now, I think there's something to be fair to be said. It was Hitler's war. He started it. It's quite clear. People write 700, 800-page books on the start of the First World War. There's hundreds of books written. This year alone, three or four books. There was five or six great books last year. And no one can decide on that. The Second World War, there's almost no one who says anything other than that was Hitler's war.
Right.
And the question that's interesting about Canada is, I think, now that we're coming up to the 75th anniversary of the start of that war, September of 1939, is why did Canada go to war again? And at this point, of course, we decide to go to war. It's not Britain that will decide it for us. And we go to war for many reasons, one of which is to stand by Britain again, and the other is because Canadians felt it was their war. And I think it's a much more complex war. In my book, The Necessary War, I'm looking at all the service arms. It's not just about the infantry this time.
Could I ask one question, not so much about the war, but about the war's effect on our relationship with our government? Because the First World War, I think many people know that income tax came in then. There were other expansions of the state, that some of which, I guess, shrunk back after war, but others didn't. Do you have thoughts on how it changed the relationship of Canadians to their government as much as to the world?
I think maybe one of the greatest impacts of the First World War is the increase of government intervention in the lives of Canadians. It's one of the longest lasting. If we think of things like how do you pay for a war? You bring in income tax and you sell war bonds and Canadians buy them and you run up an incredible debt, those are all things that last for at least a decade after the war, and income tax to this very day, and war bonds as well.
Yeah.
We see about women at the federal level receiving the right to vote in 1917. It was coming, but it's ushered in through the war.
Yeah.
We see things like government intervention into the lives of Canadians through the suspension of habeas corpus.
This is the War Measures Act.
The War Measures Act, one of the most intrusive acts ever passed, which we see brought back in the Second World War and in 1970 as well with the FLQ crisis, which allows the government to simply round up people and arrest them. Yeah. So these are wars fought for liberal values and ideas where, in the prosecution of them, we push ourselves to the limit and enter into terrain where I think no one in August 1914 or September 39 thought they were going. In fact, one of the key things to come out of this war, putting aside Canada stepping out on the world stage, the near dismemberment of the nation through the conscription crisis, the 60,000 dead, is this increased government intervention into the lives of Canadians. And as you said, it fades a little bit in the 20s, but it never entirely goes back to pre-war years, and it will only gather strength during the Second World War and in the post-war years in what will later be called the welfare state.
You've been writing on the two wars for a long time now. When was your first book published? Was it the one on gas in the war?
It was gas, that's right. 1999.
1999. Yeah. So you've written... It seems to me that your celebrated history or personal history publishing these histories has coincided with a general increase in Canadian interest and pride in Canadian military heritage. Mm-hmm. Remembrance Day seems to get bigger all the time. Maybe it was partly a result of the Afghan War being in the background here, but has that been your experience, or have you been surprised at how interested not just specialists or buffs are, but the general reading public in the kind of history you write?
Right. So my undergraduate years were 90 to 94, my graduate years from 95 to 96, my first book in 99, and then 2006, and all to the present, as you know. And I have seen a change, and I think it goes back further than the Afghanistan War. It goes back to the 1990s. And I would say it probably goes back to 94, 95, the 50th anniversary of the Second World War. That's a key event in our history where Canadians woke up after decades of having ignored veterans of the Second World War, most of the First World War veterans having passed away at that point, and realized that they were being celebrated and feted overseas as the liberators. Remember those powerful images?
Absolutely.
CBC, CTV, everyone covered that, all the newspapers.
Yeah.
These old men
going back to Normandy,
being celebrated, Canadian flags, Dutch mothers holding up babies to kiss an old veteran. It was moving stuff. That changed things. I think Canadians woke up and said, we have not held up our end of the bargain. Hmm. Now, the challenge here is, what is the bargain? It is an unsaid bargain. It is, what is the debt we owe to veterans? No one knows what that is. Some people, it's a financial recompense of some sort. It is to care for them when they are wounded. But at some level, most Canadians would agree, it is to remember. It's to remember their sacrifices, to remember what they did for our country, certainly in the two world wars. And I think we can go back to 94, 95, because then we begin to see an upsurge. Now, what's interesting about that is that's at the darkest point of the Canadian forces.
Right, right.
That's during the Somali crisis and the trials and the investigation, the very lowest point.
That's fascinating.
So there's an interesting thing happening there. I think the war in Afghanistan, you have to admit that it has changed Canadians in many ways, and that for good or for ill, pressured by some, an active case made by others, or just a simple awareness that Canadians were fighting in this long war, that we began to pay more attention to our military history.
And think about the fact that this is peaceable nation that we may be, this is a big part
of our history. I think people began to look at the peaceable nation, of which I've always been very proud of our peacekeeping heritage, but it is one that is largely around a 40-year period.
Yeah.
1956 to about the early 1990s. When you get to Somalia, Rwanda, and Bosnia, and the failures there, everyone said that peacekeeping just didn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Traditional blue-helmeted peacekeeping. Yeah. And so people began to think, we're so proud of this, as well we should have been.
Yeah.
But in fact, we have a longer military history, one that extends back to Korea, the Cold War, Korea, the two world wars, the wars of the 19th century, the wars that made our country, all the way back to First Peoples. Hmm. And that's one of the things we do here at the War Museum, of course, try to put that into context. We've never said here, and I don't think any historian would argue, that you only should study military history to understand this country.
Yeah.
But I think people have said, you're not getting a full picture if you ignore Canadian military history and its impact on this country.
That was historian Tim Cook of the Canadian War Museum in conversation with Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes.
Coming up, Green leader Elizabeth May weighs in on the challenges facing the Green Party ahead of the 2015 vote, and the U.S. ambassador to Canada talks about bilateral relations, our border, and the Keystone XL pipeline. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Still to come, U.S. Ambassador Bruce Hayman joins us to talk about bilateral relations, but first...
It's been 3 years since Elizabeth May made history as the first MP elected as a member of the Green Party. Since then, she's won praise for her performance in the House of Commons and even doubled the size of her caucus with the move of former NDP MP Bruce Heyer. But with the Liberals and NDP both showing strength, the Greens still languish in the polls. With a year to go until the next federal election, is the party any closer to a major breakthrough, or are the Greens merely treading water? To discuss the state of the Green Party, I spoke with Elizabeth May. Where do you see the party at this point, and how do you see it building towards 2015?
Well, I think we're in a very good spot as a party, and we are building and growing with a goal of being at least a full Parliament. I mean, we are recognized now as Green MPs in the House. As you mentioned, Bruce Heyer and I are both Green Party members of Parliament. And you go look at the House of Commons website and there's these, you know, two Green Party seats. It's often misunderstood that because we're not yet 12 Green MPs, which is another category of recognition within Parliament, which is gets you to that next threshold of questions every day in question period, seats on parliamentary committees, access to additional resources, that we're not somehow yet Green Parliamentary Party. You know, we are a parliamentary party. I hope to have more Green MPs even before we go to the next election in 2015, but in the next election in 2015, the party is organizing with the goal of ensuring that we have a significantly larger caucus working constructively and cooperatively to change the nature of parliamentary functioning, to decrease hyper-partisanship, to work with others, improve respect and decorum in the House, and all the things that we can do when we're more than 12.
So, but when you look at the polling, when you look at, you know, some of the by-election results, the Liberals and the NDP still seem fairly strong. In fact, the Liberals seem much stronger than they were in 2011. The Green Party hasn't had a big breakthrough in the by-elections. It hasn't had a big breakthrough in public polling. You know, where do you see the growth? Like, is it just a matter that it's going to take a long time?
No, it's the next election. I mean, in terms of by-election results, if you look at 2012, we nearly won in Calgary Center, and we were within a hair's breadth of taking Victoria. In the most recent round of by-elections, without similar levels of high-profile candidates, we were ahead of the NDP in some ridings, tied with the Conservatives and Trinity Spadina. And I have to say, one of the challenges for our candidates, particularly the last round of by-elections, is that even though we're a parliamentary party with two MPs, the mainstream media quite often, not one of our candidates in the four by-elections was interviewed by the CBC in the course of the entire by-election campaigns that ended June 30th, just as an example. So even with that kind of shutout, we're competitive with other parties. As I said, ahead of the NDP in McLeod, tied with the Conservatives in Trinity Spadina. So, you know, not necessarily places where we're going to elect Green MPs in the next election, but clearly competitive in those ridings. We are going to be, we're strongest, and this is no surprise, on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, but in other areas across the country, particularly where individual candidates who have not yet announced publicly, but who have the kind of personal reputation and credibility that will, on top of the fact that they're running as Greens, make the voters in those ridings say, oh, okay, I totally want that person to be my member of Parliament, and cool, they're also Green. So, you know, it's a realistic campaign plan that we have. You know, the national polling, certainly, if you look at national polling, you would never have thought that it was possible for me to win a seat in Saskatchewan Gulf Islands. I mean, obviously, we're stronger in certain parts of the country than others, and we can win seats.
Is it the goal, then, to get to that 12 seats, to sort of continue to build one by one? You know, is it reasonable? Like, do you see a chance for the Greens to have have a major breakthrough where you suddenly, increase by dozens of seats, or is this to you a one by one by one sort of building process?
It's one by one all at once because our hope for, I mean, obviously it would be wonderful to have 30 or 40 seats, but I'm realistic. I think 12 to 15, Bruce and I are running for re-election in our ridings. An additional 12 is reasonable. There are a lot of new ridings. There are a lot of ridings that don't have incumbents. You look across the country and you can see there's opportunity. And we're building on those opportunities with a quite disciplined campaign plan. So while we will have candidates in every riding across Canada, we're going to be putting significant resources in the ones where we see a reasonable prospect of electing an MP, and that's tied to the reputation of that individual MP, tied to the history of that part of the country being significantly concerned with issues that are associated with the Green Party. But I think also in the next election, I think democracy is going to be a huge issue, the question of excessive power in the hands of leaders, and the excessive power held by political parties per se. If that can become an election issue, which I think it really should be in the next federal election, I think we can drive up voter turnout. We can give people reasons to turn out to the polls because they're actually talking about the nature of democracy itself and not just, in the analysis that Susan Delacourt brought to Shopping for Votes. It's not just picking a different can of soup. It's actually saying, let's do some homemade soup and stop shopping in cans. I mean, it's a whole different analysis of how you get people engaged in politics and voting again. So, again, in terms of how we're going to do, we're going to build on where we're already strong, but we're going to take out a message that's not just about vote green, but about you've got to get engaged in democracy again. Canadians need to vote again. We can't allow this, as I said, this notion that we're fighting over splitting up an increasingly small body of voters who are willing to vote. We have to inspire people to believe in democracy again.
I wonder, though, if the playing field, in 2015 is almost harder than the playing field in 2011, or the way it looked immediately after 2011, in that, Justin Trudeau has brought the Liberals back up. Thomas Mulcair has at least kept the NDP decently strong. The Conservative vote hasn't collapsed. It almost feels like we're now coalescing around three major parties again. How do you, as you mentioned before, how do you get into that discussion? How do you make sure that the Green Party is relevant when there's going to be so much attention and so much discussion around those three major parties and those three leaders?
Look, our number one job is always to speak truth to power. And the three main political parties are playing unfortunately, the same kind of tired games. We're not hearing anybody talk clearly about the climate crisis. We're not hearing any leader other than me as leader of the Green Party talk about the danger of so much power in the hands of leaders. These are issues that cut across party lines. These are issues, I believe, that appeal to people who've turned off politics and aren't voting anymore. I mean, I've set a record as an MP of the highest standards of ethics, the highest level, the greatest degree of transparency, and certainly people have been very kind in recognizing me for hard work and diligence, but it's about green values, and I don't believe we're going to have any difficulty finding our space because it's an unoccupied space of being willing to tackle the tougher issues and not pander. I don't think it's going to be three equally aligned parties. I think if I were looking at trajectories, I think that the Conservative support is dropping. I certainly find it when I'm talking to Canadians from coast to coast, people who say to me, I always voted Conservative, but I'm so upset with what I see happening. I thought the Conservative Party was going to be different, but, the usual range of scandals and lack of transparency and, the top-down leadership. Then you get a lot of people who are saying, I thought that, I would agree that I think that the Liberals are getting considerable bounce from Justin Trudeau's personal magnetism. But again, we don't see where the issues are that they're going to champion in terms of real policy choices. And when they do announce a policy choice, quite often it drives Greens back to the Green Party, who might have thought, oh, Justin Trudeau looks, like a great option, except that then he says, oh, I'm, pushing for the Keystone Pipeline. Overall, I don't think we're going to have any difficulty whatsoever maintaining our space. And of course, having, two seats in Parliament before the next election, then that will, you know, involve being in the leaders' debates, which means that we're not, you know, airbrushed out of the election campaign as we were in 2011. So I think we're in a very good position.
That was Green Party leader Elizabeth May speaking about the state of her party in the lead-up to the next election.
Earlier this year, U.S. President Barack Obama appointed a new U.S. ambassador to Canada. Bruce Hayman, a former investment banker at Goldman Sachs, arrived in Ottawa in April and quickly started making the rounds by traveling the country and connecting with a lot of lawmakers. To discuss the state of U.S.-Canadian relations and making our border more efficient, political editor Paul Wells speaks with U.S. Ambassador Bruce Hayman.
You gave this big speech the other day in Ottawa, and you encouraged everyone to look at the trend lines, not at the headlines.
Yeah.
You kind of have to do that because the headlines are discouraging.
Which is why I said it, really. I mean, sometimes, and I realized this even when I did my first round of interviews, and the headlines didn't look anything like the article itself or the interview. And I read the headlines myself, and I said, gosh, I actually never really said it that way. And so I was joking half with the media team, and I said, maybe I should just do my interviews with the headline writers and forget the people who actually do the story, because maybe that'll have a better impact. And they laughed, and we talked about it. But clearly, I understand the... I understand the difference. I will tell you the content of the story between our two countries is really strong and good. But sometimes the headlines are focused on the challenges that we face. But we're going to have challenges. We'll always have some challenges. This is a very large, complex, wonderful, enduring relationship. But I don't care what relationship you're talking about, whether it's personal, professional, corporate. If it's large, it's significant and important, there will be times where we'll have things that we have to work through. But I think that sometimes we lose perspective when we just look at one part of it.
Have you watched the President and Prime Minister Harper working together? Have you had a chance to do that? Have you been in the room with them yet?
I haven't been in the room with the two of them. I've been in the room with each of them separately, but I have not been in the room with them together.
Okay. How would you characterize the relationship?
Professional. These are two very smart men. They're serious. Mm-hmm. They're roll up up your sleeves, work hard folks. And I think that they work and talk about serious things that are important to both of them. I characterize the relationship as something that you'd expect of two G7 leaders.
Alan Gottlieb, former Canadian ambassador to Washington under three prime ministers, said that you don't get a lot of progress on the big files, on the complex files, if there isn't a relationship of trust and confidence between the two heads of government. How are they doing?
Well, I wouldn't characterize there's a lack of trust and confidence. I mean, I just don't think these two gentlemen are the guys that are the ones that people want to see this just wonderful, embracing, affable, hugging kind of relationship. And I'm not sure that either of these two guys, that's their DNA. And so I think that the way they're reacting and acting together is totally in line with their personalities and what they're doing. But I actually think that they're behaving appropriately, and I do think they trust each other. There's a strong degree of trust in their relationship because they're working on difficult and challenging issues globally and bilaterally.
Generally, you cited in your speech substantial progress at Vancouver, where it's like 50% faster across the border in British Columbia. I come from Southern Ontario, and it's still pretty rough.
So it's 50% faster from 2.5 years ago.
Okay.
So you have to go back. Sometimes you forget. You know, it's like the temperature changes a few degrees, and you forget how cold or warm it was just a few degrees ago, and you get comfortable with where you are. So number one, Nexus cards are really important. Putting in the technology for Nexus, we've just passed the millionth Nexus holder, and we've demonstrated. And by the way, we monitor times it takes for people to get through the border across the 121 border crossings. What people don't realize is there are between 300,000 and 400,000 people across the border every single day, 1,200 flights. There are times where the systems back up. Certain holidays, certain events that are taking place on both sides of our border where people want to get to. But for the most part, through most of the day and most of the times, it's moving pretty well. especially if you have that Nexus card. And so I really would like to see an acceleration of Nexus holders.
I'm reading in the papers about missile defense again. More than a decade, Canada has not participated in the U.S. homeland missile defense. Now that's being reconsidered. Is that an active homeland defense program? Is there a desire to see Canadian participation? Would there be an on-ramp if Canada wanted to participate?
I think it's an internal Canadian discussion. These are the kinds of things that we will leave to Canadians to decide whether it's important for them to participate or not. As of right now, they don't participate. And I'll just leave it to the Canadian people to make a decision.
I think I should surely win a prize. 22 minutes. And neither of us has said Keystone.
I think my time's up now, isn't it? No, just kidding.
Several months ago, the ask coming out of Canadian officials is, why can we not just have a decision?
You know, this is, first of all, we appreciate the challenge of this decision process and how serious Canadians take it, and we take it equally serious. There are citizens on both sides of the 49th parallel that have very strong opinions as to the outcome of this. We've asked by law for a comment of folks, and we owe them the legal responsibility to review those comments. So on Good Friday when we announced this, that was one of the two important points that we raised. The second is the uncertainty that has been created as a result of the Nebraska court system. And as a result of the uncertainty under Nebraska, we basically said you have extended time. We have not put a final timeline on that at this point, but we gave them extended time because they need it.
There are some commentators in Canada who say if we had any skill at reading between the lines, we would understand that this much delay is our answer. The answer is no.
We have commentators, I've read those that have said it's going to be absolutely yes, it's going to be no, and it's going to be in between. Whatever those folks are doing is they're just speculating at this point.
Okay.
That's political editor Paul Wells speaking with U.S. Ambassador Bruce Hayman.
That's it for this week's episode.
For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.